This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is devastating, both for the person living with the disease and for the people around that person, family members, caregivers, friends. But as in many life experiences, there can be humor in dealing with Alzheimer's and touching moments of love, of awareness, and of healing. When Dana Walrath's mother, Alice, could no longer live on her own, she came to live with Dana and her husband. But as Walrath writes in her new graphic memoir of that time period, her motives in inviting her mother into her Vermont home were not entirely based on altruism or uncomplicated love. Walrath had a difficult relationship with her mother, and she was hoping that living together, even as Alzheimer's would take its toll, might help heal a rift she felt with her mother. And it did in many ways. Dana Walrath is an author, an artist, and a medical anthropologist, and she joins us today to share her experiences and her new book, Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. Dana, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jane. It's great to be here.
And Alzheimer's because your mother is Alice.
She is Alice. And, I mean, Alice is a name that shows up in the media again and again. And but I found the voice for this story, the visual voice, the day I cut up a cheap paperback copy of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland to make my mother's bathrobe. So it started with a series of...
And not to make her bathrobe like for her to wear,
but no.
an art piece. That you were doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a series of collage drawings. But Alice in Wonderland was the perfect metaphor for living with dementia.
Because why?
Because if you embrace the magic and the unexpected and you just let whatever happens, happens, it's a lot less difficult to deal with. I mean, obviously there's loss. Everybody feels that tremendously. But that sort of was our guiding principle, that we just had to kind of, whatever happened, happened, we would do it.
So when I said you say that it wasn't just pure altruism that made you or spurred you to invite your mother to live with you, I mean, some of it was. You're taking care of your mom. So there is a lot of duty and filial duty and also this idea of wanting to care for somebody you love. But there was also this sort of feeling of unfinished business that you had. What was that about?
Absolutely. Though I have to say I didn't realize it until I got into it that there was unfinished business. I just kept on processing it. She's too well. She's got all her social graces intact. We can't put her in a lockdown unit. And that was her only option. She had been kicked out of her apartment and then kicked out of a senior living community because she kept on trying to wander. And
even, which is a typical symptom of Alzheimer's and dementia.
Absolutely. And so I had to figure out what could work for her and what could honor her. And it was a little bit crazy. I mean, people would say, are you sure you want to do this? And I just trusted a feeling that it was the right thing to do. And it was only months into it that I realized that she was there because of unfinished business. I totally expected her to go and live with my sister because they were very close. And she and I just kind of never made that sort of a relationship. So
maybe you could read a passage. There's a part of the book that sort of speaks to this, and you know, it helps explain how you and she got at these questions of your relationship and your history together. And it's actually really through simple interactions that, you know, if you look at them on the face of them, and they could mean nothing, but if you look at them more deeply, to you especially, they really mean something. Could you read a passage?
Absolutely. This Alice turned back, and I kept brushing, watching her through the mirror. She looked up and found my eyes in the reflection. I wasn't very good to you, I'm sorry. Unfinished business. That's one of the reasons she was here living with us, but I never imagined I would hear these words stated so simply. Thanks. So you forgive me? Of course. On an intellectual level, I had forgiven her years before. How come? Because you did the best you could. But I knew that if I wanted it, Alzheimer's would let us have this conversation every single day. But forgiveness is also action, action that lets me redo the past. I wanted to stand at the same dressing table and brush her hair without yanking, without getting annoyed at her knots and chopping all her hair off. I wanted to listen to her as she spoke about her day. I wanted to guide her through uncharted territory. I wanted to face sickness of the mental sort straight on instead of sweeping it under the rug. The rhythm of the brush soothed us both. When I set the brush down on the dressing table, next to a bowl overflowing with the strands of beads that Alice loved to wear, she turned around to face me again and said, Running a hotel must be very hard. Alzheimer's.
You know, so in some ways you could say, oh, she doesn't even know what she's talking about when she says, you know, I wasn't very good to you. But what did you feel in that moment?
Oh, it was so genuine. I had just at that moment, she had asked me the question, Dana, why are you so good to me? And I said, because you're my mother. And she said, I'm your mother. Who's your daddy? And then when I explained it to her, she said, ah, yes, I remember. But in those months when she first moved in with us, she was, because I think one of the interesting things that can happen in dementia is people open up in ways. They might become more reflective. They let go of the social rules that kept them from going to certain places. And my mother, one by one, was going through things that she was feeling very bad about. So she had to talk about her younger brother who had Down syndrome and then was institutionalized and died there when he was about 10 years old. She had such guilt towards her parents who were both survivors of the Armenian genocide and that she hadn't visited their graves. So, you know, eventually wish she was going to get around to me.
What did she have to apologize for with you?
I think that we had one of those family dynamics where she and my brother and sister were a unit. They looked alike. They were more, my mother's Armenian and they looked more Armenian. And I grew up always hearing, boy, they look so much alike. Where did you come from? And I was a very busy, active kid. And my mother was also working her tail off to give us everything that she didn't have as a poor immigrant kid in New York City growing up. And so she was just exhausted. And she could sense that, you know, I could just take care of myself. And she was worried about my older brother who was struggling. And I sort of took care of myself. But that leaves you feeling like, hey, what about me or something like that. But I got that during dementia, which was fascinating.
But after that conversation, you didn't say, okay, great, now you can go live in New York with my sister.
No, definitely not. I mean, it really was true that the act of having her there gave me so many things. For example, I'm an artist and a writer now, but growing up, my mother would say, oh, you'll never get a job doing that. You should go to medical school. So during dementia, she said that she wished she had gone to medical school. And all of a sudden, everything made sense. And then she's looking around in my house at everything I had created and said to me during dementia, you should quit your job and make art full time. So dementia gave us an opportunity to meet as human beings. And so I really came to appreciate who she was and really appreciate how much she did, in fact, give me. So I think our families make us learn things.
I'm talking with Dana Walrath about her new book, Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. And Dana, I'm sure you've heard from other people who have had experiences with family members and they've found connections. And so I'd love to open up the conversation to any listeners who are listening who, if you've had an experience, maybe you've come through it and you have had a chance to reflect on what it was like to care for a loved one or be with a loved one who has Alzheimer's or dementia. What emerged in your own life or in your relationship that was unexpected? And what are you hearing in Dana's story that you'd like to reflect on yourself? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dana, you are a writer and an artist, but you also did move into the medical field. You're a medical anthropologist. How do you think that framed your thinking on your mother's diagnosis and illness?
Oh, it was so useful. It just gave me a perspective that I could understand why we're all so terrified of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. What medical anthropologists do is they look at the cultural aspects of healing systems, and every single society has their own sets of beliefs and practices having to do with sickness and health. And we come from a society that believes in science. Our doctors' powers come from scientific research and so forth, and their main job is to prevent death and to cure diseases. And it's also a system based on a separation between the mind and the body. And it's a system based on numbers and all those kinds of things. And we think of it as science and fact, but it's really something we've all internalized as kids. Like, for example, Jane, when you were sick as a kid, what did you do? What happened?
Usually I'd get my temperature taken and then I'd stay home and one of my parents would have to try to not be at work that day and take care of me for the day.
Absolutely. And that's completely our medical system. So as a little kid, you learned that your temperature proved whether you were really sick or not. It wasn't how you felt. It was that thermometer. And then you learned that you were excused from normal activities and that your loved ones would care for you. So these are the kinds of things that we all embody about our healing system. So then come along and think about dementia. So it's a mind problem. We stigmatize mind problems in our society. It's at the end of life. And it ultimately leads to death. It is also a sickness that makes us more and more dependent. And we're a society that believes that independence is one of the most important things. And so put all those things together, and dementia terrifies us, and the end of life terrifies us, death terrifies us. And I look at other medical systems from other cultures where death is a much more normal part of life. And so I could very easily use that anthropological toolkit to say, okay, well, biomedicine's good, and my mother's really a great patient when we go visit the physicians. But what else can we do to make up for that stigma? So it was like a toolkit that I had.
How did you then, I mean, thinking about the ways you reflect on our cultural ideas of illness and what people should be doing, you know, you mentioned that your mother would walk away from where she was living in New York, and that's one of the common symptoms of dementia. And another one is not understanding where you are in time and space. And so maybe you're living as a child, you're 10 years old, and you believe that you're a 10-year-old still. And your mother would have these sort of, not hallucinations exactly, but this idea that she was someplace other than the present. And how did you deal with that?
Oh, absolutely. That happened all the time. She'd come downstairs, oh my gosh, I've missed the school bus. And I'd say, no, don't worry, no school, you're on vacation. And my oldest son told me that that's actually using a principle from improv comedy called the yes and principle. So whatever the person does, you just say yes and you add to it. So yes, she thought she missed the school bus. No, you didn't miss the school bus, but I affirm the fact that she really was someone going to school. So we didn't challenge those things on a regular basis. And that tied back, too, to the anthropological training, because we, as anthropologists, we have to keep lots of realities in our head all at once. So it's the people we study, our own biases from our cultural backgrounds, our theoretical frameworks, and that just was so handy with dementia, because she had one reality, I had another one, and I could always make it safe for us to rejoin. And so the yes and, you know, if she'd be hallucinating, which she did quite a bit of, or she was someplace else and I was there, we just said, you are a superhero. You've got special powers. You can fly. You can see things we can't see. And that honored what she was experiencing, so we didn't have to get into fights about what she was experiencing.
Like she would say she could see your father in a tree, and your father had died years earlier.
That's exactly right. And so she saw him in the tree. Every time we'd go out for a walk, he was up there in the maple trees, and we eventually learned to use it. So we'd say, and this was with the help of another healing, other healing traditions. So as a medical anthropologist, my job at UVM was to bring, one of the many things was to bring alternative and integrative kinds of healing into the medical curriculum. And so when my mother was sick, I just took advantage of those different kinds of things. And Hakomi therapy is this method of understanding what people are experiencing in their bodies. And so Martha Whitney, a Hakomi therapist in Burlington, met with my mother and noticed that whenever she spoke about my father, she would look up and she'd put her hand across her heart. So then when she would say, where's Dave? Where is he? You know, I expected him for dinner or whatever. I could just say, put your hand over your heart and rub your heart and look up. And she would always say, ah, yes, there he is.
Did you get advice from more doctors more steeped in Western medical tradition to do things differently, either to not indulge those fantasies or visions or to change your habits. Like you talk about when your family would eat dinner.
Yeah.
And you said, we're going to eat dinner when we want to eat dinner, not what conforms to, you know, my mother's needs based on dementia and this idea of sundowning,
right,
for example.
Yes, there were times that the doctors would suggest things and I'd know we just couldn't do it. The biggest one is my mother was always starving. Many people with dementia have the opposite problem. They don't want to eat. But Alice was starving, and she made up stories that pirates, they had her on a desert island, and she hadn't eaten in a week 45 minutes after breakfast. And her doctor was saying, she's got to lose some weight. And I just knew it would make her miserable to restrict food. And in fact, when she first transitioned to memory care, that first place wouldn't let her eat whenever she wanted to. And it led into a disaster. There was a case that we had to really do things differently from what the doctor suggested. Doctors suggest don't wander. We let Alice wander with the dog, and we're lucky we live in Vermont and it's a dirt road. But I was there saying they've got their rules that they have to explain to patients because that's their role. But my role as a daughter is to help her keep her dignity. And wandering was part of that. And then the dog would always report back or lead her back.
Or tell you she's gone off, you better go find her.
Right.
Yeah, so when you talk about her desire to eat and this feeling of starvation, you trace that back to her Armenian roots.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Armenian genocide of 1915 involved marching people out into the desert, and the people were just utterly emaciated, dying from starvation and exposure. And I think that everybody who has that in their family has a particular relationship to food. And most of my mother's first cousins were really, really large, and my mother was svelte, and that was always really important to her. And I think the first time in her life that she was ever overweight was during dementia. And now, you know, where she's living, the whole kitchen staff adores her because she's one of the few people that eats with gusto still.
We should point out here, you have written the book in the past tense, and it's about the time that your mother spent living with you and your husband,
yes,
at your home. But your mother is still alive.
She is still alive. We're well into our second decade of dementia. It has a 10 to 20 year course, and I don't know how much longer it's going to go, but she's in a wheelchair. She's missing her front teeth. And when she lost them, I started thinking, well, she's channeling her inner kindergartner. She's, you know, been in diapers for 6 years and so forth. So, but in the middle of that, she's still got a beautiful smile. When I visit her nowadays, I mostly read the Tao Te Ching to her, which she hated last summer, but she loves now. So
whatever works.
Exactly.
We're talking about what it's like to care for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease and how one local author took her experience and turned it into a graphic memoir. If you hear something in Dana Walrath's story that resonates with you, or if you have a question for her, or if you'd like to share your own perspective on the experience of caring for somebody you love who has Alzheimer's disease, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about this interesting format of the book, as well as what made the difference for Dana in terms of deciding when the right time was for her mother to move into a specialized living facility. Because it wasn't about the diapers. It wasn't about incontinence. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a little bit about what was the turning point. Again, 1-800-639-2211. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with Vermont author, artist, and medical anthropologist Dana Walrath about her new memoir, Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. It's about her experience caring for her sick mother. And we're hearing from some of you, we hope, with some experience in this. We'd love to get your perspective, what it's been like to try to process the experience, or maybe you're in it and this feels a little bit too raw to be thinking about being reflective. But what are you experiencing? What are you finding in your relationship changing with the person who you know who has dementia or Alzheimer's? Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Dana, we were just talking about the fact that your mother doesn't live with you now, but she is still alive and living in a specialized care unit. What did make the decision for you, or what were you thinking the factors would be in terms of how long your mother could stay with you and when the right time would be to transition to a new living environment?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, my mother made it incredibly easy on us because there was a moment early in dementia where we're driving down Browns Trace Road and their lilacs are in bloom. And my mother said, "What am I doing here?" And I explained she lived with us. She had dementia. She said, "You live here? This is pretty." And then she said, "Promise me you'll do something different when it gets too hard." So all the way along, I was thinking about what was that turning point. And when I spoke about it with my husband, we thought it would be the incontinence. And instead, or he thought it might be that, he suggested that. And I said, "You know what? It's if she turns mean." And we saw none of that meanness until just before. And what she started doing then was throwing things at Peter, hitting him with a broom. She started taking the lining out of her Depends and leaving it in my studio. And I said, "Okay, this is the turning point." And when I said to her, "You're going to go to a school for people with Alzheimer's disease and it'll be good." And she said to me, "Oh, good. I love school." And then all those behaviors evaporated. And what I learned from that is she was trying to communicate somehow or another that she knew it was time, something wasn't right with the picture. And that was also an act of generosity and kindness. And I think that when we approach the dementia just looking at what people are doing as just these aberrant behaviors, instead of looking at how that might be an attempt to communicate when you don't have all your usual verbal skills, it opens up all sorts of ways of being and living.
You also write about your husband and how unflappable he was through this situation. And one moment where your mother essentially propositioned him because she was having this sort of hallucination and she was captured by pirates and she said, "You need to jump in bed with me. And if I'm not pregnant by tomorrow, we're going to be in trouble." And your husband sounds sort of amazing in this passage of being able to calmly say, "I'm sorry, that's not possible, Alice. That is not happening."
"I'm your son-in-law." And she said, "Who's my daughter?" And then she said, "How old am I?" And I mean, she immediately shifted gears. That's something to really understand about people with dementia. They've lost their short-term memory, but they've retained sophisticated thinking and all sorts of things. And that if you give them the facts, they'll put together the right story.
But as you said, give them the facts, but do it in a way that preserves their ability to believe what they believe in the moment.
Right.
Because you didn't say, "No, you know, this is what's happening now. Get it with the picture. Get in the present day."
You were
very calm and sort of allowing your mom to have this idea of where and who she was.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that if we then go back to those anthropological models and think about the stigma, that comes from us dehumanizing somebody and thinking of them as lesser and not really having emotions and not really having an ability to have agency and think for themselves. And I think that the more we can return that agency and that humanity to somebody with any sort of stigmatized condition, the easier it is for them.
Let's go to Nancy, who's calling in from Brookfield. Hi, Nancy. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for your wonderful presentation. I'm eager to read the book. My mother has passed away, but in processing the years I spent caring for her while she had dementia, I always struggled with at that time and still somewhat do, my family members' response to her dementia. And while they were always kind and generous, and this excludes my immediate husband, who was very involved and very generous, but those who were not directly involved in her care seemed to think that she wasn't present and couldn't, in spite of all of my sharing the actual vignettes of scenes where my mother was demonstrating that higher intellectual capacity that you described, in spite of her inability to communicate, you know, in normal channels, they just couldn't get their head around that. And I'm wondering if in your own experience or perhaps in the work you do, you've encountered some ways that other family members who are not maybe as directly involved with the mother, father, et cetera, person with dementia, could be sensitized to understanding this person does still exist and is there in their in the most fullest of ways.
Nancy, thank you for your call. I appreciate that. In case I think your phone line was a little difficult to understand for some people. So just to encapsulate what you were asking about, this idea of how do you talk to other family members about making sure that they respect the personhood of the person who you love who has Alzheimer's and may be different, but you know still has sort of an essential personhood. Not exactly what Nancy said. But
it's an excellent point, Nancy. And yes, absolutely, I dealt with that as well. And I think that it all comes from people's fear that they see someone that's missing what we think of as being human, and they're thinking about, oh my gosh, that could happen to me, that could be me, and what would I do, that they pull away. And what you asked is, well, how to handle it. I was determined to get it down into a book so that people could read these stories and then hear some of the kinds of insights and presence that somebody with dementia really has. I mean, so someone could say, well, yes, they're really present, but if you have a story that shows them really being present and then a story that's illustrated that shows them so that you're sort of really seeing them, I think that does a lot towards sensitizing people, making them less afraid and making them more able to accept the humanity and personhood of the person who has lost their short-term memory.
You say, so you have pictures in this book, and most of them are drawings that
yes.
you've made of your mother, and you have a very distinct way of drawing her. And you mentioned using a copy of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland as sort of a scrap or paper that you could use to create her clothing. And so it's sort of scrapbook-like with pencil drawings. And why did you want to take this approach of having so many pictures that you've created of your vision of your mother in addition to the words?
Yeah. When Alice was living with us is when I discovered graphic narratives, comics, and I just absolutely fell in love with them. And so did she. So I read in quick succession Art Spiegelman's Mouse, Alison Bechdel's The Fun Home, Jean Lun Yang's American Born Chinese, Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis. I mean, there was book after book coming into the house. And Alice picked up every single one and adored them. And I was realizing that she was bringing in the story by this visual channel and that was really helping. So I was determined that when I told this story that it was going to be visual because I wanted someone with dementia to be able to access it. So the book contains a series of comics that I drew without any of the essay parts of the book. And that was sort of my first foray into trying to capture the whole experience. And it had only 324 words, but it still tells a story. And then from there, it expanded into writing a story in response to each picture. But I feel like that's out there to do exactly what you asked about, Nancy.
When you were creating these comics, what did that do for you? In addition to now being something that's accessible to people who are in different states of life, how did making that artwork help you?
It really, it was, And exorcism isn't exactly the right word, but I was processing everything and honoring everything. That's why exorcism isn't the right word. I mean, we had a lot of magic and joy in those times, that in the years that we lived together. And so the drawings capture that magic. There was a whimsy about the whole experience and a magic. And so I was learning what I thought about it as I made the drawings and then as I wrote the essays. I think art lets us process things that we know subconsciously. I think that all art is a way of connecting with subconscious knowledge, and then we put it out there in the world so that other people can also experience that.
I'm talking with Dana Walrath. Her new book is called Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. Would you read another passage for us?
Absolutely.
And you have, I mean, this book, as you said, has these drawings and then different very, very short essays that sort of go along with the drawing that you're representing. And I'd love for you to take an excerpt of one.
Okay. This is from Alice Ungrounded. On quiet afternoons at our house, you could hear my mother reading out loud to herself, her intuitive effort to bring the information in by another channel to make it stick. Witnessing this led me to revive the family bedtime story, a ritual that improved her sleeping and that helped me find our common ground. We started with Anna Sewell's Black Beauty. The first night, she checked in about the voice. Horses can't write, can they? She listened with the rapt, wide-eyed attention of a child, moaning when any creature, large or small, was harmed. When Black Beauty struggled to be well-behaved, Alice whispered to her stuffed bear, "It's hard to be good, isn't it?" Alzheimer's.
There's a tenderness there, Dana, but I also wonder if it was difficult to in some ways be reversing your roles and reading to your mother as if she was a child and watching her have these sort of childlike reactions to things.
She was so genuine that it brought out tenderness. And I think that we never have the privilege of knowing our parents as children. And I, through dementia, got to see who she was as a young person. And that was really a remarkable gift. It was something that I feel so lucky to have had, and sort of wish that when someone got the diagnosis of dementia, that a physician would say, "Hey, this is an opportunity. You can learn things about this person that you might never have known." So, and sure, it was in some ways strange to take on that role, but in other ways, it was the most natural thing in the world. She was a member of my family. There's a famous Billy Collins poem, The Lanyard, about how we can never, really repay our mothers. But when you care for them at the end of their lives, you are repaying that.
Let's go to Lindsay, who's calling in from Austin, Texas. Hi, Lindsay. Go right ahead. Hi, Lindsay. Are you there? All right, we'll see if we can get Lindsay. You know, it's wonderful when you mention that, you are repaying them in a way, and you're taking this role and reversing it, but also saying, I owe you something, but I owe you something because of this love that we have. You keep referring to Alice, your mother, in the book and in our conversation as Alice. What do you call her in real life?
In real life, I tend to call her Nana. When her oldest grandchild was born 37 or 8 years ago, she started going by Nana, and that was her title, she said. And so I tend to use that when it's just the two of us. And when I'm with her where she's living, I do use Alice because there's continuity with the caregivers and so forth. And I'm using it here because we're talking about the book, but I tend to call her Nana and or Na. And it's sort of, it ties into this idea that comes from anthropology. I mean, who exactly are we? What's our identity? And she always, almost always when she lived with us, knew that I was Dana, but she didn't know I was her daughter. And people always, when they know she's still alive, ask me, does she recognize you, as though that's the essence of who we are. And what I've learned is what's important is not that she knows Dana, but that she knows I'm decent and trustworthy and that it's safe to be with me.
I'm sorry we couldn't get Lindsay on the line with you. She told our call screener that she's read your book, and I think the question that she essentially wanted to get to was, how do you be a good friend to someone who has Alzheimer's? So, you know, you're a daughter, and you're living with your mother in the time period that you're writing about. How do you be a good friend to someone with dementia?
I think you stay connected. I think what happens is most people disappear. So just be there, and be there, figure out interesting, different ways to do things with them. That connection will keep everything, will keep the friendship growing. And so that's
even if it's awkward, you know, even if you are going through those times where the person doesn't necessarily recognize you or has these different traits of their personality coming out that you may not recognize.
Yeah, I think it is awkward, but we have our short-term memories intact and we can sort of bracket off and deal with that grief and the awkwardness and the loss aside and then come to them just open. Think of it about like approaching them as a young child who's very sensitive to emotional cues and body language. And just if you can be there with an open heart, it's amazing what will happen.
Dana Walrath is a medical anthropologist, a writer, and a visual artist. Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass, is her graphic memoir of her experience caring for her mother who has that diagnosis. Dana's having a book launch on Friday evening, the 20th, at Burlington City Arts. We have the details at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Dana, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, a free sunscreen dispenser in Burlington sounds useful, maybe quirky, but it signals an effort to address why Vermonters are at high risk of a preventable cancer, melanoma. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Given that many Vermonters woke up to snow this morning, it may seem like an odd juxtaposition that the topic we turn to next is how exposure to the sun is leading to high rates of skin cancer in our region. But it might be precisely that lack of consistent sunny weather that makes us more lackadaisical than we should be about the risks of melanoma. New Englanders are particularly at risk of developing melanoma, and yet we're not very good about taking preventive measures like applying sunscreen when we should. A new free sunscreen dispenser in Burlington won't do much to curb the cancer rate, but it does highlight this problem. And joining us now is Deb Girard, Executive Director of the Melanoma Foundation of New England, which is part of the organization's Practice Safe Skin program. They are putting this sunscreen dispenser in there. Deb, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to join you.
How dangerous is skin cancer? You know, it often seems like it's sort of portrayed as a minor inconvenience rather than a dangerous health risk.
Well, that's a very good point. And in fact, the majority of the 5 million skin cancers that will be diagnosed in the course of a year can be removed surgically. And, you know, cure rates are very high. But it's that small population of, you know, about 76,000 people that will be diagnosed with a melanoma this year. And of those, about close to 10,000 people will die from the disease.
So this can be a fatal disease, and people need to recognize that.
Absolutely. Melanoma in its later phases is very often fatal. And you know, in 40 years, we had no new treatments for melanoma. And within the last 4 or 5 years, we've begun to see some very promising research that is extending people's lives with melanoma. But really, the best way to deal with it is not to get it to start with. So this issue about prevention, I think, is timely and extraordinarily important.
Why are Vermonters more at risk of developing melanoma than people in other parts of the country?
Well, I think that the issue with the high rate is really about your population, that you have a very, very high Caucasian population, probably the highest in New England anyway. And as a result, there, you know, the highest incidence of melanoma also occurs with Caucasians.
So it's skin type and the lightness of your skin, but I also wonder, given that New England is a higher risk place, if it has to do with how we're sort of evaluating our risk or lack of evaluation and taking the precautions like sunscreen or hats.
Exactly.
Or clothes.
And you know, we understand that people don't love sunscreen, but you are going to not love having to get skin cancer removed either. I think that the important thing is that we are really looking for ways to improve the awareness that people are getting about sun protection. And we're looking not only at sunscreen, but we've recently seen some sunscreen studies that can tell us that consistent use of a sunscreen with an SPF 50 can cut melanoma by 80%. It's a study that recently came out, and I think a very important one, but it's not the only way that we protect ourselves. You know, wear a hat when you're outside, wear sunglasses to protect your eyes, wear protective clothing when you can. Those are all equally important things.
You know, when it comes to that idea of sunscreen, I understand that, you know, sometimes you see parents being pretty cautious about kids. You know, I have a toddler and we now have to slather him in sunscreen before he even gets to school. And yet I'm not putting it on my face, even if I'm going to go for a walk later in the day.
Well, that's a really good point. We started this sunscreen project last year. We beta tested it in Boston. And we spent a lot of time sitting and watching people's sunscreen use. And what we saw was exactly what you were just talking about. We would very often see parents who were fastidiously putting sunscreen on their kids, and then we would watch, and they would walk away and do nothing for themselves. And, you know, much like you see around the issues of, you know, wearing bike helmets, where kids do it and parents don't do it. You know, trying to come up with a way to make sunscreen more accessible has been a very important program for us.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, in Vermont, for example, you are trying to remind people not just to apply sunscreen on sunny summer days when you're headed to the beach, but if you're going to be outside in the wintertime, snowshoeing or cross-country skiing or downhill skiing, you should be putting sunscreen on. Or maybe you should have a face cream that has it all the time. Is it a hard sell in this part of the country to get people to pay attention?
I think it's a less hard sell than it used to be. And one of the reasons that we decided to do sunscreen, you know, trying to get sunscreen dispensers out to outdoor spaces is that, you know, people often will put sunscreen on before they leave in the morning to, you know, go have a day out in out the out of doors, but not take sunscreen with them to reapply. And really the only way that sunscreen is going to work is if you reapply every couple of hours, and if you swim, that some sunscreens say they're water resistant, but I say don't pay any attention to that and reapply after swimming.
So there's this free sunscreen dispenser now going into Burlington, and you know, one sunscreen dispenser in one public location is probably not going to get enough
Correct.
People to bend the curve on rates of melanoma. So what's the idea here in this program?
So actually, Burlington's going to receive two dispensers. And what we did in January is we put out an RFP, and we opened it to cities and towns around New England. And further, we actually had some programs out in Nevada and Texas, and we're going to open this up nationally. But our idea is, if our real goal is to make sure that at some point in time all outdoor spaces will have access to sunscreen, we gave out 200 sunscreen dispensers and cases of sunscreen, and then we're hoping that communities will continue to support them, and that companies will support their communities by purchasing sunscreen dispensers for their, you know, for their communities and their bike paths and beaches and parks, pretty much any place where people gather.
Deb, we just have a couple seconds left here, but in addition to trying to get people to be more aware of the risks and take some precautions like sunscreen and hats and sunglasses, how are you working with people to try to detect potential cases of melanoma and get people into treatment?
Well, one of the things that we're doing is we have a program called the Skinny on Skin. And this is a program that we've developed for hairstylist, massage therapist, esthetician, anybody that looks at your skin regularly. And what we're teaching them about is how to look for new or changing moles on their client, in their client's scalp, in the back of their neck, particularly places where you can't see yourself. Doctors are not known for, you know, coming through your hair to look for things on your scalp, and quite realistically, melanomas of the scalp are the most lethal. So we are we've been working on this program for a few years and trained thousands of beauty professionals, and we are just launching an e-learning site so that any of these beauty professionals around can go to the site. They can take our class.
And we'll put a link to that up at vpr.net. We're going to stop you there, Deb. Deb Gerard is Executive Director of the Melanoma Foundation of New England. Thanks for talking with us. And listeners, be sure to ask your hairdresser to check your scalp for melanoma as well as cut your hair in that fashionable, fabulous style. That's it for today. Tomorrow, uncovering the links between diet, obesity, and disease. We'll talk with a top medical researcher about his work studying some of the mechanisms behind America's obesity epidemic. You can send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen for the program tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.